Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Miller, your host today, along with my partner, orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Keith Mankin. We also host the popular medical podcast, Pure Spectrum. Today's guest is journalist and author Wendy Moore. Her new book, No Man's Land, explores the World War I British military hospital known as Indle Street, a hospital run by two suffragette doctors, Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray, a hospital staffed almost completely by women who treated over 26,000 wounded soldiers. It's a fascinating book, published by Atlantic Books in the UK and Basic Books here in the US in April of 2020. Wendy, we're delighted to have you. Thanks for joining us here on this Thursday afternoon, your time, Thursday morning for us.
Yeah, pleasure to join you today.
Wendy, you know, Keith and I were talking about your book that we're going to be discussing today last night, and we're both a little bit embarrassed that we didn't know more about this story. I mean, this is a really important story, and is this more well known in the UK than is perhaps here in the US? Or, you know, have you found many people encountering this story for the first time?
No, I think it's equally unknown in the UK as it is in America. It's really a forgotten story, I think, probably because the hospital itself was demolished, so it ceased to exist. And all memories of it seem to have been really erased. So nobody really in the UK, till I've written this book, knew very much about it at all.
Well, how'd you come across it? What sparked your interest?
Well, I'm a journalist by training, so I've written most of my career about medicine and hospitals. But I've always been interested in history, so I did a medical history diploma. And because of that, I started writing books. So I've written four books so far on medical and social history. So that's my real passion, is bringing medical history stories to a wider population. So with this book, my fifth book, I was looking for another really good story. And by chance, I walked into the Wellcome Library for the History of Medicine in London, which is my favourite place to be.
Makes
and
sense.
I saw an amazing picture on the wall, and it's an oil painting by a war artist called Francis Dodd. And it shows an operating theatre completely staffed by women. So all the doctors are female. And I was sort of, I did a double take because this would be unusual enough today to see that. Even today, it's relatively rare for surgeons to be female in Britain. And then I realised this was a picture from the First World War, and it was showing an operating theatre in a military hospital in London. And so I was absolutely captivated and decided that I had to investigate and find out more about it.
Yeah, I think it's included here in the middle of the book, right? It's one of the
That's right, yes. Yeah. It is quite a romanticized picture, actually. It's quite a fascinating picture, I think, in its own right.
Yeah, we're going to get into that here in a little bit. It's interesting, is, you know, this is a century ago, and yet, at least for people like me and Keith, it's still a very familiar environment. I mean, you can see the anesthesiologist, right? You know, that could be Murray in this case, Dr. Murray. Not all the equipment and intubation tubes and everything you see today, but it's more of a mask with probably chloroform. But everybody's situated in a similar position. There's what look like a Mayo stand, a back table. It's kind of a way of putting you into history through a familiar lens, at least for us and probably many in our audience.
Let's talk a little bit about, I think it'd be helpful just to give us a little review and set the stage here. I mean, you know, we're going back to the First World War. We're also talking about women's rights movements. Women still cannot vote either in the UK or here in the US. New Zealand was way ahead of everybody on that, but everybody else was a step or two behind. And then, you know, kind of paint the landscape briefly for us so we can get in and start looking at some of these women, especially Anderson and Murray.
Well, in the UK, women doctors, women had won the right to qualify as doctors in Victorian times. So, in fact, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was the first doctor to train in Britain to become a doctor in 1865. So women doctors were able to become to treat people, but they were still, by the First World War, they were more or less ghettoized into treating only women and children. So women doctors were not normally allowed to work in mainstream general hospitals. They were not, they didn't generally get surgery posts. They weren't, it was taboo for them to treat men. So they were effectively sidelined into working only in hospitals that were run by women to treat women and children.
So it'd probably be helpful, too, to understand what medicine and healthcare and hospitals look like then, too, right? So today there's the NHS, and if no one was familiar with that, there certainly are now after the COVID-19 epidemic. But that's not what was the case then. So hospitals look very different than each other and how they were funded, who was allowed to go there. Kind of paint that landscape for us so we understand what we're dealing with.
Yeah, so, well, essentially there were two types of hospitals. There were charity hospitals, which were financed by voluntary subscribers, and there were hospitals which were funded by local authorities, and they had developed out of them the infirmaries of workhouses. But none of them were entirely free. People who went there had to pay a small subscription or depend on the goodwill of a doctor. But they were mainly for the poor. So anybody who could afford to avoid a hospital did so. They would go into a private nursing home or be treated in their own homes. So hospitals were generally for poor paying patients. And they were staffed by doctors who worked there for free. So they were honorary appointments. Most doctors, in fact, worked as either general practitioners, so family doctors essentially, or they had private practices as consultants. And then they would go into the hospitals on a kind of weekly basis. But hospitals were generally places that most people tried to avoid. In a pre-antibiotic age, they were really seen quite rightly as centres of infection.
So the people who were the doctors then in these charity hospitals were actually people who could afford to not take pay. Either did they have private practices on their own that they supplemented, or were these the non-working class, the upper class to some degree?
Yeah. So, but people who became doctors were the only people that could become doctors were those who could afford to do so. So they built up a lucrative private practice, and then they would go into work in a charity hospital. Maybe for one afternoon a week. So that was a kind of a charitable thing that they did. But they also then got to teach medical students as well. Mm-hmm. So they would get fees from the medical students for that.
Yeah. And you do make the point about the lack of antibiotics, also a lack of a lot of surgical techniques. Abdominal wounds were lethal, really things that we kind of take for granted now. We were probably at that point closer to medieval medicine than we were to modern medicine. And really what this story, what spans the time when modern medicine really started coming in, I think.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, especially in the First World War, this became far more acute because so many of the wounds that the men were suffering in the First World War on the battlefield became infected with gangrene.
Right.
And so to begin with, surgeons didn't even bother to try to heal or to operate on an abdominal wound or a chest wound any, you know, real sort of internal wound like that, they would just leave, they'd be left to die. But also many of the compound fractures, the men who got those died from gangrene. It was very primitive. It was a real sort of a shocking environment for doctors, you know, both male and eventually female as well.
And the other part of the backstory that I think is not surprising, but I don't think American audiences really appreciate, is the militancy of the suffragettes and the movement that was going on. Could you fill us in a little bit? I realize we don't have hours to talk about the whole story, mm-hmm. but yeah. It really does set the scene for our heroes here.
Yeah.
Where did that come from, and how active was it? And it was really a society shattering activity for these women.
But the two women, the main two women in my story, so Flora Murray and Louisa Garrett Anderson, both had joined the suffragettes movement. So as doctors, they had been stymied from working in mainstream hospitals, but they were both frustrated, really angry about this discrimination. And as part of that, they had joined the suffragettes movement. So Louisa Garrett Anderson, she was the daughter of Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, the first British doctor, woman doctor in the UK. Her aunt, Millicent Fawcett, was actually the leader of the suffragist movement, who were the non-militant campaigners. So she'd really been brought up in this environment of women fighting for their rights and fighting against discrimination. So it was no surprise whatsoever that she wanted to campaign for the vote. So Louisa Garrett Anderson, she initially joined her aunt's movement, the suffragists, but she quite soon became disillusioned with this. It didn't seem to be making any headway. The government at the time kept making promises to the suffragists so that women would eventually get the vote, but nothing was happening. And so she, like many other women at the time, joined the suffragettes, and that was Mrs. Pankhurst's movement, who decided to actually take militant action to try to achieve their aims. And their motto was deeds, not words. So she actually went to prison for 4 weeks for smashing a window. So that was a really quite serious sort of action and a dangerous thing to do for her reputation. Her Flora Murray, who she met in the suffragette movement, she took even more risky action, really. She didn't go to prison, but she became the main doctor looking after the suffragette movement. So she was seen as being the honorary physician to the suffragettes. She treated Mrs. Pankhurst and many of the suffragettes when they'd been to prison and they'd been force-fed and come out extremely ill and very weak, and she nursed them back to health. But she also helped some of them to evade the police and to escape capture. So I think she was taking even more sort of risky action for her reputation. The suffragettes had begun by small protests, by disrupting election campaigning meetings and hanging banners up and so on. But this did escalate, and by 1914 it had become quite a sort of really quite violent campaign. They were actually starting fires and setting bombs. I think it got to a point where there's almost no return, which is the point at which the First World War broke out. And at that point, the suffragettes then and the suffragists both suspended their campaigns to support the war effort.
Yeah, which is really interesting because it was a huge sacrifice. But we'll see this shortly here, you know, how much these women were actually needed. I was just one more thing on this. I mean, we talk about militancy. I was really surprised by some of the level of violence. I mean, I can imagine their frustration. And a lot of these women came from more privileged backgrounds. So when you say their reputation, that really did mean something, right, Wendy? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a simple fleeting thing.
That's right. I mean, most of the women really did come from quite sort of, wealthy backgrounds. There were lots of kind of titled ladies who supported the suffragettes who also went to prison. Louisa Garrett Anderson, in fact, she was one of the founders of a movement to refuse to pay income tax. So that was one of the campaigns to try to get the government to change its mind. And she also led marches by women doctors against calling for the vote. So in fact, there were lots of women doctors who did support the suffragette movement. I think they were probably more angry than other women in particular, because they had a qualification exactly the same as their male colleagues, but they were being effectively barred from doing the same work. And although they were professional women who, you know, some of them were earning reasonable amounts of money, they had their own houses, they were denied representation, so they were denied the vote. So I can completely understand their anger.
Do you think that they're the actions of the women doctors going to Europe and setting up the field hospitals, or even setting up Endell Street ultimately, did they do it as an opportunity? Do you think they said, okay, this is our chance to show the world we can do this? Or do you think they did it out of patriotic, well, patriotic is the wrong word, but just because it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think very much both of those things. I think they did want to serve their country, but they also realized this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that they could actually prove their worth. So at the start of the war, there were about 1,000 women doctors in Britain. And when war broke out, about 60 of them immediately volunteered their services to the War Office. But they were told very bluntly that they weren't wanted, that women doctors were not needed in the army. So several of them actually then started to set up their own units to work abroad. In fact, Flora Murray and Louisa Garrett Anderson were the first two women doctors to take a unit abroad. And so they did that in the middle of September. So just about 6 weeks after the outbreak of the war, they had gathered together other women doctors, nurses, raised £2,000, collected supplies, and organised a trip so that they could actually take their team to Paris.
So just before we jump into that, I want to cover one more thing. So you've answered part of my question here, but when Elizabeth Garrett Anderson became the first licensed physician in the UK, we go from, 1865 to just the outbreak of war in 1914, 1,000 women doctors in practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where were most of them training? And let's start with Elizabeth. You know, what was involved with her breaking through and getting into what presumably is a male dominated, medical school? And how did that kind of separate a little bit into one track for women and another one for men?
Well, yes. I mean, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson had a huge battle to get her qualification. She wasn't the first woman doctor to join the medical register. That was actually Elizabeth Blackwell, who'd been born in Britain, but she actually got her qualification in America.
That's right.
So she then came to Britain briefly and put her name on the register. As soon as she'd done that, the authorities in Britain stopped anyone joining the register who'd got a qualification abroad. So that route was ended. So Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, she tried to train at universities all over Britain. She approached every medical school, every hospital, and she was denied the opportunity to get her qualification by usual means. So eventually she had to do an apprenticeship with an apothecary. And through that way, after doing a 5-year apprenticeship in a hospital working for an apothecary, she then was granted a license through the Society of Apothecaries. And at that point, that enabled somebody to join the register. But as soon as she did that, that route was closed. So everything she did was stopped. She actually managed to join the British Medical Association, her local organisation. And when she got to the main conference, the members suddenly realised they'd inadvertently allowed a woman to join, and so no women were allowed to join the British Medical Association for the next 19 years. So she was a pioneer, but she was on her own for a very long time after that. And so she and another doctor really helped to found a medical school specifically for women. So that was the London School of Medicine for Women, and that became attached to the Royal Free Hospital. And virtually all of the women doctors, even up to the First World War, had got their training through the London School of Medicine for Women.
So because the vast
majority of medical schools in Britain were still not allowing women to train there.
So maybe 1,000 doctors in 1914. How many doctors total do you think at that point?
I don't know the actual figure, but they were still a small percentage.
Yeah, very small. That's more what I was getting at. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, yeah, sorry to divert you there. So now we're back to the outbreak of the war. Give us, because you spent a lot of time in this, right, in thinking about this. Give us a sense of how people felt about this war. I mean, in some ways there was, it was an excitement. We're going to go push the Germans back. But there was a lot of shock too, right? I mean, I think a lot of people didn't expect this to actually become what it did. And then obviously they expected to wrap up in less than a year and it didn't. So give us a sense of how most people looked at this.
Yeah, I think right up until the outbreak of war in August 1914, most British people were not expecting Britain to get involved in the war at all. So it came as quite a huge shock when Britain did declare war on Germany for having invaded Belgium. And then very quickly, people did mobilise. So Britain had a very small army at that point. That army mobilised and went to France. And the government began recruiting to get more people into the army. So there was a kind of big push of patriotism. It really was patriotism, where young men were going and getting drunk, some of them, and then signing up together, forming what we call pals battalions, so battalions of friends. So there was a big recruitment push, That kind of tailed off after a while. So I think it definitely would have felt like a long war. I think there were huge deprivations. There were restrictions on movement. Rationing came in. And for people on the home front, it was a very grueling war. And the war did really come right into the centre of London as well. So there were many wounded men walking down the streets in the cafes and restaurants. There were 300 hospitals receiving wounded just in London. Ambulance trains arriving day after day. Crowds were surging around railway stations, waiting to greet the wounded.
Not to mention the Zeppelin airships dropping bombs on people.
Exactly. I mean,
these kinds of things.
I mean, for me, that was one of the kind of quite shocking things in my research, because I'd not really understood what it was like that these huge zeppelins appeared in the sky over London at a time when airplanes had only recently been invented. So people were so amazed, they didn't run and hide. They actually came out of their houses to watch these incredible airships coming over London and then raining down bombs on people.
In some cases, it was as crude as just like dropping a grenade, right? I mean, they were just throwing them like rocks over an overpass.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not a munitions expert, but some of them did a lot of damage and killed a lot of people. And later on in the war, there were airplanes coming over as well, dropping quite heavy bombs and right in the center of London as well.
Yeah, I was struck by a passage early on where you mentioned that somebody who was wounded on the front had arrived at Endell Street like in 24 hours, which, you think of Europe as being far away from London. We do here. And really, the war was almost right on the doorstep, even if it wasn't, even without the Zeppelin. So it was really immediate. They could hear the battles from the coast, which is amazing.
Yes, indeed. That was more towards the later years, of course, because to begin with, the medical services were really in chaos. They were just overwhelmed by the scale of the wounded and the extent of the injuries. And to begin with, it could take as long as 2 weeks for a soldier to go through the various stages and get back to a hospital in London. So they did get incredibly efficient. And towards the end of the war, yes, somebody could be wounded at dawn and then arrive back even that afternoon in London.
That really is amazing, actually.
It really is, yeah. At a time when you don't think about mass transport at all, it's just so amazing that they could mobilize. But you bring up the efficiency, and I think that what serves as sort of the prologue, the efforts of doctors Murray and Anderson in Paris and outside of Paris, the way they establish their own efficiency is just brilliant. How much did they learn? I mean, clearly it worked in Endell Street. Did they leave a record? Were other hospitals setting up with similar efficiency, or was this really a unique, spectacular thing in this time?
You talk about France.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So to begin with, the medical services were really overwhelmed and were not coping. People went out there and discovered that men were getting wounded. And hospitals in Paris were actually empty, so they were not getting the wounded to where the beds were. So, in fact, Murray and Anderson were working in a. They took over a hotel in Paris. It was a luxury hotel that had only recently opened, but never had guests. And they converted that into a hospital. There were other charitable units, and there was also an American unit who also set up hospitals in Paris to receive the wounded. But they were having to go out and forage for patients to begin with, sending up their own ambulances to railway stations to try and bring back the wounded. There wasn't an organised transport of wounded coming back to Paris.
We talk about ambulances. It wasn't always vehicles, was it? I mean, sometimes it was horse-drawn carriages. I mean, these were kind of rough trips for some of these soldiers.
Certainly the first few months of the First World War, the army was relying almost entirely on horse-drawn ambulances to convey the wounded. It's absolutely incredible because obviously the horses were slow, they got lame, they needed feeding and watering, and they got bogged down in the mud. So sometimes the stretcher bearers found they had to pull the ambulance carts themselves. The chaos was indescribable, really, absolutely shocking. And this was at a time to begin with when the army was having to retreat, so they were constantly having to, they were on the back foot, really. But by the end of 1914, the army had really tried to get a grip on things and started to make big improvements. So they then started sending up motorised ambulances, they started using ambulance trains. They began to set up field hospitals, which closer to the front line, which were bigger, where they could do more operations and more serious operations. So the first few months were very, very difficult. But by the beginning of 1915, the army was getting better organized.
Not to get us off track, I didn't even think about this till now, but did you ever look on the other side of the fence, so to speak? I mean, did the Germans have a similar experience? Maybe were there women doctors who did anything over there? Or we don't have to get too off track. I was just curious.
I don't think there were women doctors. I know the French army didn't have women doctors. Yeah. I'm almost certain that the German army didn't either. I think the Russian army did have women doctors. I'm pretty sure about that. And there were other women doctors, British women doctors, who did later go out to France and also to Serbia in particular and set up hospitals there and later also in Russia. So really it's a matter of necessity. Armies realised that they needed to use women doctors, that they basically didn't have enough male doctors to treat all the wounded. So they actually became reliant on women doctors as well.
Let's go back to, Anderson and Murray here. Talk a little bit about, their relationship, how they worked together. There's a little bit known, I guess, of their personal life, but it doesn't seem like a lot. You know, we can maybe more guess on certain things. But talk about the initial hospital they set up in France, what they were up against, and then how there's some political moves here, too. They're pretty astute in this, I'd say especially Anderson, navigating the system, fighting against some of the red tape. tell us what they were up against and how they basically just decided they wanted to get involved, and they did.
Yeah, well, so Anderson and Murray have both got about 10 years experience as doctors, but they'd only ever treated women and children previously. They had together run a hospital for children, a very tiny hospital with just 7 beds.
Make sure, what are their medical backgrounds, just so we, in case we didn't mention earlier?
Yeah, they've had both of them had trained at the London School of Medicine for Women.
But their specialties, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. But they both trained at London School of Medicine for Women. Louisa Garrett Anderson had become a surgeon, but she was working in what was called the New Hospital for Women. So it was a hospital that actually her mother had founded that treated only women. So she had some experience in gynecology and some general surgery, but only ever treated women. Flora was a physician and also an anaesthetist, and she had also only worked in hospitals treating women, but together they'd also run a hospital for children. So she had experience of anaesthesia for women and for children.
So
they were also life partners.
Right.
They've met each other in the suffragette movement, but then they had become partners. They lived together effectively as a married couple. They had identical diamond rings. They really saw their mission, I think, to go to France as a demonstration of their mutual love for each other. It was a sign of their commitment, and throughout the war I think that was really important. They were absolutely devoted to each other, absolutely committed and totally determined to achieve what they wanted to do.
Their backgrounds, right, we talked about this, they're come from, you know, more upper class backgrounds. Was there just an understood sense of duty that you do get involved in some way or another? Was it a little more heightened with both of them? I mean, and I have to imagine part of it was just maybe adventure is the wrong word, but they wanted to get involved and they wanted experience and they knew they would get it there. I mean, let's talk a little bit more about their motivations as far as we can imagine.
They both had come from fairly privileged backgrounds. Louisa Garrett Anderson's family were quite wealthy. She'd actually set up a practice in Harley Street, so she did have her own private income. Flora Murray's family, they came from landed gentry in Scotland. So her father had been the laird. So they had, she'd grown up in a large house with large grounds. But she hadn't had much ready cash, like a lot of aristocracy at the time. They had property, but they didn't have much kind of disposable income. So she'd had more of a financial struggle, really. But they'd both been to girls' boarding school. So they'd both been brought up, really, to think to do their duty for their country. But they'd had enlightened upbringings as well, and especially, you know, having joined the suffragette movement. So they certainly were motivated by an ambition to prove that women doctors could do exactly the same jobs as men. And Flora Murray was very candid about that. She later said she saw this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to prove women doctors were exactly the same, exactly as capable as men.
So I found it a surprise with the milieu of what was going on, the sort of, even during the war, there was still skepticism of women doctors and everything. And I've got to say, reading your book, I was surprised when they got back, having closed their French field hospitals, and have the government say, open this hospital for us. When you were researching that, did you get a sense of surprise? Flora and Louisa surprised by this? Where did this come from?
Yeah, I think things did change very rapidly, in fact. So they had set up the hospital in Paris. Right. Initially, they had army doctors, army officials come to look round it, coming quite hostile to begin with, expecting it to not be very good. But they were so impressed by what they saw that they then decided to support the women. And so some of these army officials actually became their allies and their advocates. And so when they then set up a second hospital near Boulogne, so near the front line on the coast. The army doctors actually said to them, yes, you know, this can be part of an official army organisation. So that was the first hospital in the British Army to be run by women doctors. And on the basis of that, that was so successful that word got back to the War Office in London. So the army doctors in France, that their praise got to the head of the British Army's medical services, Sir Alfred Keogh. And so it was him who then met with the two women and gave them the invitation to run a major military hospital in London. And they were surprised. It was unprecedented that this should happen, that women doctors should be officially sanctioned to work in the army. And it was a measure of necessity, largely, because by that point, many male doctors had been killed in action. And so the army knew very well they needed more hospitals in London. They needed many more doctors. So there was definitely a necessity there. But even so, Keogh himself was taking a very brave step. He described it later as a gamble. And many of his own colleagues had tried to persuade him not to go ahead. They thought it was too risky. And many of them were saying that this hospital, the London hospital, would not survive for 6 months. So there were still great reservations about it. And even when they set up their hospital in London, so they were given a workhouse in the centre of London to convert into a military hospital. And even at that point, there was lots of opposition, and the War Office, many of the people at the War Office were as unhelpful as they could be. So they were still really battering against a brick wall in many cases.
Let's talk about the soldiers a bit. I mean, what was their perception of being treated by women? I mean, almost none of them ever had, you know, unless they had, you know, been treated as children in one of these hospitals, I presume. What did they think? And what was the state of many of them coming in? I mean, some of them weren't necessarily in a position to be fully aware of what was going on because of their wounds. Yeah.
Well, this is one of the great fears, and the big objections was that men would not want to be treated by women doctors, and that soldiers would be, shocked and not, that it was kind of unseemly for women doctors to treat men, to see them unclothed and to treat them and to deal with wounds in sensitive places, for example, despite the fact, obviously, that there were female nurses that were doing all these jobs. But this was one of the big objections. To begin with, some of the men who arrived at End of Street on these convoys came off ambulance trains, were taken there by ambulances, and they looked around and they were surrounded by women doctors, and not just women doctors, but the whole hospital was staffed by women. So it was women stretcher bearers, women orderlies, women did all of the work. They were so surprised that they actually thought they'd been sent there to die, because they couldn't think of another reason why they should be sent to a hospital that was staffed by women. But they really very quickly changed their minds. And there are lots of stories of soldiers describing it as the best hospital in London, the most popular, the most successful. So there really wasn't this problem at all. They all very quickly accepted being treated by women doctors. And not only that, they decided that they were actually the best. So that perceived problem was clearly not really an issue at all.
I was I'm struck, and there's so much we could talk about, and we don't have time to get into everything. Urge people to read the book because it's such a great book and it's such a great story. But as a physician myself, I'm struck by the modernness of the way they set about putting together Endell Street. The way they designed the rooms and the way they thought about the patient. I mean, the whole recreational thing, which you have lots and lots of information about. The way they did research, the way they used innovation. Did they know they were innovating? Did they try to say, okay, this is our chance to design something that's going to be even better than anything. And it is head and shoulder. I mean, you look at the numbers and the death rates are nothing compared to the other hospitals at the time. Were they aware of this? Was that a conscious effort on their parts?
Yeah, I think it was very much so. I think they felt they did have to prove that they could run a hospital that was absolutely equal to any other military hospital in Britain, but not just equal, but not only equal, but better. Mm. So the two women would tell their staff, you've not just got to be as good as the men, you've got to be better than the men. So they prided themselves on running a hospital that was efficient, professional, that was pioneering in surgical terms. And they made various innovations. They introduced a new antiseptic ointment, for example, which was highly effective. They had a reputation for good outcome measures, for a low death rate. But they, at the same time, they did perceive it as being equal but better and different, because they thought that as women they could run a hospital that also had feminine touches, basically. So Louisa Garrett Anderson, who was the chief surgeon, she said that many of the men were more wounded in their minds than in their bodies. So she was very aware of the need to motivate the men, to help them heal mentally as well as physically. And so for that reason, she went out of her way to make sure that the hospital was always bright and cheerful. The wards were colourful. There were fresh flowers everywhere. And there were constant entertainments. There were plays and pantomimes. There were concerts and visitors all the time. So it was a kind of relentless tide of visitors and things happening just to keep men's spirits up high. They were even taught knitting and needlework as a kind of occupational therapy. And they also were particularly good at physiotherapy. So that was in its early stages. And also x-rays, which was, again, another area that was in its very early stages as a specialty.
Remarkable. Yeah. And I love the quote that you have about that Dr. Anderson talking to giving a presentation, talking about that it was like treating 550 large babies. If you find the way to treat children, what toys they like, what they like for tea, what frightens them the most, you have a great way to find out how to run a military hospital.
It's just
absolutely brilliant. And they did. They applied the women and children's experience to adults. And I think that might have been one of the ways that it was successful.
That's right. But I think there was also a class element to this, because most of the men who were treated were ordinary soldiers, so Tommies they were called, really. And so most of them came from quite working class backgrounds, whereas the women who worked there, not only the doctors, but many of the orderlies, came from middle class or upper class backgrounds, were quite privileged. So I think that was quite significant in terms of keeping discipline and maintaining respect and belief in what they were doing. So there was definitely that element as well.
Yeah. And they're always dealing with the cloud of knowing that all of their work may be for nothing, because they're going to send these guys right back to where they were injured, right? I mean, how did they deal with that?
Yeah, I think that was really poignant. I mean, some of them talked about how it was very similar to being in the suffragette movement, because the suffragettes went to prison, they were force-fed, they came out, the doctors got them better again, and then they had to go back to prison. But this was obviously even more poignant. And I came across quite a lot of stories of men who'd been wounded and went to Endell Street and were patched up and sent back to the front and then killed later on. So I think it was very close to them. And I think as the years went on, it did kind of wear on them, and the staff found towards the end, the later years, that it was quite exhausting and grueling and quite tiring. So I think that eventually did have its toll on them.
Well, just like Keith was saying, I mean, there's so much here to talk about, and we're getting closer to the time. I mean, there's everything from signing Florence Nightingale's death certificate to, treating a soldier who was one of the police officers who arrested one of them during a protest. I mean, there's just all sorts of just amazing little things in here. But I don't want to skip past talking about the epidemic, Spanish flu. Let's talk a little bit about, kind of skipping ahead here so we don't miss that, considering we're still in the middle of COVID-19 here. Tell us a little bit about that, Wendy.
Well, yes, exactly. Well, when the war ended, Endell Street stayed open for another year. So the doctors then treated the victims of the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919. And the second wave, which was the most lethal wave of the pandemic, actually hit Britain at the very time of the armistice. So November 1918, where people were out celebrating in the streets that peace had come, that's when the flu hit its really highest peak. And so Endell Street became inundated by patients with the flu. So not only soldiers, but local people as well were admitted. And I think that was really the darkest time, because the staff had really kept going throughout the war through this sort of camaraderie and patriotic spirit of fighting the common enemy. But they were powerless against this invisible enemy, the flu virus. There was very little they could do to help patients, only nurse them and give them fluids and hope for the best. So, in fact, the death toll at the hospital per week was higher during the flu epidemic than it had been during the war per week. So that was incredibly depressing and hard for the staff, and also literally difficult, because many of the staff got ill too with the flu, and at least four of them actually died of the flu. So, yeah, there are definitely parallels with what health staff in particular are going through at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, but even reading that, you see that their approach to the flu was very modern, that they seem to understand isolation, that they seem to understand. And if you think about it, in a time where they didn't really have the masks and the protective equipment, a small number died and a number got sick, but the numbers of the people infected, of the caregivers, were not as high as you would be expected to. Mm-hmm. So clearly they were on to something. I wish we had the lessons, which yeah. I think leads to the way to end this, to talk about, you know, this wonderful heart lifting story, but really the punchline of it is the legacy is disappointing, that it took years for us to get back to a point where they were, and largely because it got buried. I got the sense reading the final chapters that it was a source of bitterness for both Dr. Murray and Dr. Anderson, and for a lot of the people working. And mm-hmm. How could we have ignored that much success, that much experience? Mm-hmm. Colin and I were talking about that. What are your thoughts about that? And what did it take to jostle people out of this complacency and this ridiculous misogyny that they had?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely shocking, because when the hospital closed, the women doctors and all the women staff had to go back to doing exactly the jobs they'd done before. So all the women doctors had to go back to just treating women and children. The hospitals again stopped recruiting women doctors. The women doctors who'd worked there throughout the war, who'd kept the hospitals open in the war, they were sacked, and no more women doctors were recruited in the hospitals. Medical schools, which had opened their doors to women students in the war, closed their doors again. So all the experience that these women doctors and particularly surgeons had gained through the war was lost. There was lots of frustration, lots of anger. Some of the women doctors, were very bitter. They actually tried for many years to get jobs in mainstream hospitals and were knocked back. And even if women doctors did get jobs, if they got married, they were not then allowed to carry on. So there was a marriage bar that was in place till as late as the 1970s. So it was not until the Second World War that women doctors again were allowed to work in the British Army. But even after that, there was another backlash and women were pushed back again. So it was not really until the Sex Discrimination Act of 1975 in Britain that women were given equal chances to work in hospitals and in medicine generally. And not until that 2000 that equal numbers of women were enrolled in medical schools. So it's very recent that women doctors have had any semblance of equality. And many women doctors I speak to now still find it very frustrating that they are still not getting into top jobs, top levels of specialties. So there's still a long way to go, I think, still.
Yeah. And I think about the lost opportunity. I mean, Dr. Anderson did 7,000 cases or more during her time there. Just the ability to teach and to teach important trauma that would have been so helpful for World War II. But of course, as you pointed out in your book, people wanted to wipe out the memory of World War I. It's over. We don't even have to think about it anymore. And we lost that entire generation of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think we're still finding the pieces. I mean, again, this story that you've told, and just from a standpoint, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and it's curious that we're taught that Robert Jones during World War I is the father of orthopedic surgery. Mm-hmm. And yet for the first time ever, I read in the book that that really a lot of the limb work and the brace work and the surgical work was done at Endell Street. And that's really where the pioneering was. We have no idea. All we know is Robert Jones.
I suppose that's what happens in medical history, isn't it? That certain people get adopted as the pioneers and other people get forgotten and left out, and frequently the women are not remembered and erased from history. So so there were many women doctors who worked at Endell Street. Some of them had come from Australia and from Canada, went back to their countries and had the same situation where they couldn't get well paid, well respected jobs. It's just hard to imagine, I think, how angry and frustrated they must have been and how determined they were to try and change things ultimately.
Well, this is always a challenging time in history to read about, too, because you just come away feeling really dejected when you read about World War One. I mean, it was just such an overwhelming, senseless loss of people for nothing. Nothing was learned. And then it was just like an intermission between, First World War and the Second World War. I mean, it's just incredible. And I guess this is part of it, but, and plus, you're talking to Americans, we always like a happy ending, We're still looking for it. Where is it?
I should say, I think a lot of the book is actually quite uplifting.
Because
during the war, the women who worked at Endell Street really were having the time of their lives. They were doing something they were good at, that they were respected for the first time. They had independence for the first time.
Camaraderie there, working team.
Exactly that. And when Flora Murray died not soon after the war, and later Louisa Garrett Anderson died, and on Flora's tombstone, the words were added, "We have been gloriously happy." And so that's what I take away from the story, that they did what they wanted to do, and they proved that they could do it, and they died happy.
After going through something like this and the tight bonds that developed, did you find that these women, as they went their separate ways, continued to correspond with each other? Were there ever reunions, anything like that? Or did it just kind of disperse into history?
Yeah, certainly some of them did keep up contact. And Louisa Gatt Anderson actually visited Australia at one point. So she went there and met up with some of the surgeons who'd worked for her at Endell Street. There were certainly bonds there, yeah.
Well, Wendy, we're at the end of the hour, unfortunately. I just can't say it enough. I mean, people should pick up your book because we just scratched the surface here. We say that a lot, though, don't we, Keith? Because
that's right.
That's why we pick these books. But I don't know. It's got to feel satisfying, Wendy, to write something like this, right? I mean, some of these records, probably no one's looked at them since, maybe the times they were put together, right? I mean, some of the research you were doing. It's hard to show gratitude to people so long ago that did forge a path for us and for others. But I guess this is a way of doing it, isn't it, Wendy?
Yeah, I mean, I feel it's probably the most important book I've ever written.
Really?
And one of the most enjoyable also, because through writing it, I got in touch with lots of families of women doctors who'd worked there. So grandsons and granddaughters of women who'd worked at Endell Street, but also grandchildren of men who'd been treated there. So who shared their stories and pictures with me. So it was very moving to write it and incredibly enjoyable. And I just feel it's a really important story to be shared more widely.
It absolutely is. Well, Wendy, to close things out, tell everybody listening here how they can learn more about you, more about your work, and more about either Endell Street or No Man's Land, depending where you're picking up the book, and of course where they can pick up the book.
Right. Okay. So, so the book's titled Endell Street in the UK. It's No Man's Land in America. And there's, yeah, there's more information on my website, which is www.wendymoore.org.
Well, we'll get links up to that on the website as we always do, so everybody can take a look at it in further depth. But Wendy Moore, thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, I knew this was going to be a great conversation. We're looking forward to it, but it's just really special to explore something we know so little about, but we really should. I mean, this is a great.
Well, thank you. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you both. I'm very grateful for it.
Well, everybody, wherever, whenever you listen to us, take care, and we'll see you here next time.